Hello, everybody. Good afternoon or good morning, I guess, depending on where you are. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm really excited to be moderating today's webinar on the art of the collection letter, which is being brought to you by Microbuilt. The collection letter has been around for as long as people have been trying to collect on unpaid debts. And while there are so many disclosure requirements to include, it can get lost that the letter is still an attempt to make a connection with someone. In this webinar, sponsored by Microbuilt, a panel of leading collection industry executives are here to share their insights into how to artfully craft collection letters so that they are compliant and effective. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. LaDonna Bowling is the Chief Compliance Officer with Receivable Solutions, Inc. She has more than 20 years of operational and compliance experience in third-party debt collections, experience in all verticals serving creditors and debt buyers. LaDonna is a certified instructor for ACA International and was named one of the 25 most influential women in collections by Collection Advisor magazine. She was also the ACA International Certified Instructor of the Year for 2019. Ari Derman serves as General Counsel and Chief Legal Officer for Harris & Harris. Ari is the company's key legal strategist on all major business transactions and complex compliance matters. As part of his role, he advises executive management on regulatory issues within the industry, drafts and negotiates client and vendor contracts, spearheads all legal defense efforts for the company, and oversees the selection and management of all outside counsel. Furthermore, under his direction and supervision, Harris's legal compliance department researches new collection legislation and case law, handles corporate licensing and insurance matters, and facilitates training for account representatives. Jeff Endebach is the managing compliance attorney at Harris & Harris. He conducts legal research, counsels the company on regulatory issues, and oversees its compliance management program. He also manages regulatory compliance audits and assists with the company's legal defense efforts in coordination with outside counsel. Brent Yarbrough is a principal with Maurice Wutcher, a national financial services law firm, and is based in the firm's Birmingham, Alabama office. He primarily focuses his practice on regulatory compliance in the defense of consumer law claims. Also joining us today is the wood chipper that is next door outside of my office. So I apologize if you can hear that in the background. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please hit the Q&A button on your Zoom webinar control panel, type in your question and submit it electronically. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, before we get into our discussion, I want to ask everybody to reserve a minute and fill out the feedback survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email in the next day or so to access the survey. Your feedback and your participation helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and to find the speakers you want to hear from. So thanks in advance for sharing your insights on that. With that, let's jump into the discussion. Ari, you're on my screen, so you get the honor of the first question. Are collection letters a chance for collection agencies to get creative in trying to get individuals to open envelopes and contact them? How creative can or should an agency get? We'll start with an easy one.
Sure. And first off, I just want to say thanks, Mike. It's great to be back in the mix with you after the new year. Great panel. Really excited to bring Jeff Endebach, who's alongside me, who is living and breathing collection letters every day on behalf of Harris and has some great insight he can provide because he helps me with this every day. In terms of letters, we hear all the time, and I know you might get to this a little later, we're hearing all the time about emails and texting and the methods of communication rather than, the letters themselves, or in this case, trying to get someone to open a letter or creative strategies to, someone's got 45 bills in a mailbox. How do you get yours to the top of the list. Still think it's somewhat of a dangerous game to, you know, the most creative methods are always the ones that come closest to the line, have no case law on it. I've seen some interesting things out there, like the machines that do the handwriting with pen on the envelopes. And I've been tempted to try it, but I feel like whenever we see it on display, it looks great. But if you do that the wrong way, if it looks more like an image, I feel like that's the first letter someone would throw out if it's not real pen or if it's not really high quality. So I don't know if anybody, you know, on the panel or if anybody out there in the audience has ever tried that, but I always thought it was interesting. But you know, I think a great way or a great strategy to get creative is there are always some clients you have, and maybe not, but in typically where you may have debts that are non-FDCPA. For us, that might be something related to parking tickets, or it might be, you know, not other non-consumer transactions, commercial accounts. Some of you might do business process outsourcing, first party collections, where, you know, you have a little exemption from the FDCPA. It might be a time to get creative with the envelopes and see what actually works to see if there's, you know, some uncertainty. That might be something to say, look, the rate of return is X. We don't know if this envelope with, you know, this kind of writing is going to, you know, fail in court, but it's worth a shot because we know how darn good it is from, you know, the parking stuff we've done. So I don't know if I have any magic bullets as to get someone to open up an envelope, but I see some things that have definitely kind of piqued my interest lately.
Ari, I would throw away the envelopes that look like they were handwritten. I've gotten a couple of offers, and I recognize them usually as somebody that I'm not doing business with, and I just trash them. So maybe that'll help you if you want to think about doing that in your shop. I used orange envelopes in a non-FDCPA collection attempt for several years, and the open rate on the orange envelopes was very effective. And the return rate with inbound mail coming back to us, because we would track our mail through IMB codes and such, was like a 22% rate, which was pretty good. And these were all small balance, kind of similar to parking signs. So that was effective for us.
Was the pen stuff you see, was the quality degraded a little bit? Because I saw something at ACA a couple years ago. It was an awesome it was actually written by a pen. It never went through it. It seemed interesting, but you're saying you'd throw it out even if it was real pen.
Yeah, it looked fake. It was the letters were just too consistent. I knew it wasn't handwritten, and I could tell by the return envelope that it wasn't somebody that I did business with regularly, so ripped it in half and threw it in the trash with the other things that I didn't want, like bills to pay.
Hey, LaDonna, this is Jeff. One of the things we've done in the past was just use different office supplies for some of the envelopes that we mail to consumers. I think one example was DHL envelopes that we didn't send them using DHL. We sent them by regular mail, but I think it certainly made the envelope more appealing for a consumer to open than maybe just a plain white envelope might.
Yeah, that's an idea. And you know, the FDCPA really doesn't talk about envelopes as far as color and such goes.
Right. The orange one is an interesting one for our, you know, I'm thinking about it, as you said, a good open rate for the parking stuff. It sort of mimics, you know, what they might have gotten on the initial citation for something like that.
I tried it on some late stage and I was getting a good open rate on it, but to be honest with you, I got scared and stopped using it after tax season, but it worked.
Right.
This is Brent, and I don't know that I have any helpful solutions in terms of being creative. Unfortunately, the only time I see an option. You know.
Hey, Brent, we're losing you. You're kind of cutting in and out.
Here.
Brent? think we've lost Brent.
We may have lost Brent. Certainly don't want to lose his advice on this piece. Let's give him a second to see if he can recalibrate.
Sure.
But we still have Jeff, right?
Yes, we still have Jeff.
Yep, still here.
Yes, well, we still.
While we're waiting, one of the things that I've seen personally I think it was like mortgage refinance advertisements that were, you know, like somewhat scammy advertisements that they sent out. One of them had a window envelope that looked very similar to the envelopes that the IRS uses. They have like a very particular envelope that, you know, with their logo and everything. But yeah, the window envelope alone was enough to get me to open it.
Because it had like a larger window.
Now, yeah, it was course, a much larger window.
What
yeah.
everyone thinks here is, you know, account numbers moving into that window, yep. tap testing, not trying to avoid some of these, you know, now we have, you know, QR code litigation and all that. But if you're able to do it successfully, kind of have, you know, playing with the structure of the envelope itself, even an 8, you know, not folding it, but putting it in an 8x10, those are usually more important mail when it comes. I know yep. my insurance policy or whatever it is, homeowner's insurance, is going to come in that 8x10 with a window in the same place. And it might say, you know, confidential, you know, whatever. Obviously, there's restrictions, Mike. You know, it's no one wants to put red text all over an envelope and risk a claim when it might not even be that effective at the end of the day. And I think a lot of the focus has been on the methods, therefore, of delivering it and seeing, hey, what's better than an envelope generally, rather than, hey, let's, you know, create a better mousetrap of the envelope.
So y'all are kind of unique. You have an agency, but you're also attorneys. So how much of a risk is your shop willing to take, you know, in order to get the consumer's attention? You know, do you draw the line somewhere? Because, you know, from if I put my operations hat on, you know, I kind of push the envelope, so to speak, a little farther than I do when I wear my compliance hat.
Well, I think, you know, part of it is, and Jeff and I, it's unique in a sense because we have this very large collection agency, Harris & Harris LTD. We also are part of a much smaller collection law firm that we can pivot to for certain, you know, litigation initiatives or wage garnishments instead of having a forward firm. Let's say for this discussion, you know, what we're doing for the agency is putting our compliance hats on and reining in operations, people much like yourself, which we love and respect very much, but sort of reviewing letters from an agency standpoint, how much you can push it. We're always, you know, part of our role is the legal defense as well of the company. So we're seeing when a letter results in litigation, we're seeing when a letter results in an uptick of AG complaints, BBB complaints, and when to pivot and change that. So, you know, we're a little more risk adverse than someone in traditional operations might be, but I think there's a healthy balance in, you know, if Jeff and I were to craft a letter or look at an envelope or, you know, do things and we were asked to create it from scratch, operations may not love it quite as much, yet we're able to sort of reel them in and rein them in when things they want to do are a little bit on, you know, the riskier side. In terms of the envelope stuff, we really, outside of, you know, buying some different packing supplies, like using the DHL envelopes to say, hey, people don't usually get stuff from DHL. They sell their envelopes to you. You use them. Maybe people think it's something a little bit new. That hasn't been an area we've really focused on, even though we're handling a bunch of non-FDCPA debts. I'd say some of the more creative stuff or language probably happens on the letter itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brent, are you back with us?
I am back. Yeah, our internet just went down completely for a minute. I have no idea why.
I will say that before I let you jump in, we were on the phone for a good 15 minutes, and Brent had no problems until he, you know, got up to talk for the first time during the webinar. So
yeah, just at the second when I was about to say you can't do anything fun with your envelopes, I got cut off. So. Don't know how that would have happened.
No problem.
I think Jeff overshadowed him.
I'm sorry?
I said, I think Jeff overshadowed him.
Right. No, just on the envelopes, I was going to say, you know, I only see them when they're part of a lawsuit. So, you know, I'm probably better at saying what you can't do. And, you know, the only thing the FDCPA really says about envelopes is the prohibition on using any language or symbol other than the collector's address when communicating with the consumer. And you can only use your business name, of course, if it doesn't indicate that you're in the collection business. And we see a lot of, you know, I've even seen ridiculous lawsuits that literally anything on an envelope besides the collector's address and their name, if it doesn't indicate that they're in debt collection, violates that section of the FDCPA. Now, most, you know, a lot of courts have adopted a benign symbol exception to that, that as long as what you're saying on there doesn't, on the envelope doesn't indicate that you've got debt collection going on, and then it's okay. And we've also all seen the lawsuits over the QR codes. If someone scans a QR code and picks up any information that is related to debt collection, either that's on the letter or visible through a window on the letter, then that causes problems. But you know, whether using orange envelopes or anything else interesting or you know, handwriting or the appearance of handwriting, I don't know if any of that's going to improve an open rate, but you know, I would say the only way to make sure you don't run afoul of this section of the FDCPA is to just use the address and make sure nothing about debt collection is showing up.
Yeah, but you know, letters are such a tradition, and that's what our industry has relied on, letters and phone calls. And now there's so much in the industry about using communication channels. Are y'all sending emails or texting or anything to get the consumer's attention?
You know, it's Ari here. It's so hard, and we're trying to launch an email program now. And I think the CFPB, you know, these proposed rules, they yeah. certainly don't frown upon it. They encourage it. That's exciting to Jeff and I. But I'll tell you, and I think this is where a lot of people are starting email programs are on reminder letters, second letters, after you're making some inroads with the consumer on the phone or after a validation, you know, letter after a G notice is going out. Because it is awfully hard to run a validation, a G notice program on email. I'm not saying it's impossible, but right. there's a lot of considerations. You know how e-sign is correlates. I mean that's a you know they separate the law separates statutorily mandated notices like your G, your 1692 G letter versus other reminder notices. Not that on those other secondary ones you could say whatever you want, but it's a lot easier when you've got an email, you've sent your, you know, what's mandated by law by mail, you know, you've checked that box, and the creativity of the method on your second letter can really help, you know, it's more targeted and it's, there's less boxes to check because you've already, you know, of course you've got to have your warnings, you've got to have everything on there, but you're not tracking receipt. I mean, look at the MedOne case. Look at this, where you put a link in an email and someone says, well, you've got the technology to know, collection agency, that they didn't click the link to open it. We know the email is delivered, but that's not a validation letter if they haven't clicked, opened it, and showed, you know, opening on it. So I think I don't see the paper letter going away until some of those issues are sorted through, yet second letters, third letters, quote unquote, Hail Mary letters, there's gonna be a great efficiency and cost into doing the text route or the email route with those, I think.
Yeah, and I think cost is hitting it on the head right there, you know, as a huge help from an operational perspective, and then being able to track your open rate and then build, you know, calling campaigns around that because you know the consumer's opened it. So then you can reach out because it kind of legitimizes you, so to speak. And you make that contact with the consumer as a follow up to the email that, you know, we know you received.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, one of the validation notice is kind of just checking a statutorily required box. And one thing that can help drive the movement to emails is in the validation letter, kind of encouraging consumers to go to, whether it's a payment portal or a consumer assistance portal, drive them to go online and reach out to your agency that way so that future communications with them can be through email.
Jeffrey, have you seen, because you handle this every day for us, have you seen folks going online using our, like, we have a payment portal on there.
Yeah.
And people can print a receipt, for example, if they pay. Has that reduced a lot of the requests for receipts, which we were, I mean, we were sitting there having someone manually write up letters and receipts and putting language on there and having it go through a review and doing that in-house instead of even, you know, now I think we've got a little more sophisticated with that, but the receipts were more one-off. Do we see less of them now?
We do.
The portal?
Yeah, for, well, you know, a lot of people might, you know, pay and they need immediate proof of payment, whether it's for a loan officer that they have to give it to or whomever. But so, you know, we can drive them to the payment portal. It gives them access to an immediate confirmation of their payment that they can print out and use. We also give them, kind of point them towards a consumer assistance portal where they can ask questions about their debt or get information on who they need to talk to for payment plans, things like that.
Okay, I just want to jump in for a minute here. At this point, I want to talk for a little bit about the sponsor of today's webinar. For more than 35 years, Microbuilt has been helping businesses assess and manage risk. They were a pioneer in the now exploding alternative credit data space, and as such, have refined their products and services to deliver true business value. Over the years, Microbuilt has invested heavily in acquiring best-in-class data. They've built sophisticated systems for keeping their data fresh and accurate, and powerful predictive models for making decisions around lending, leasing, collections, and risk management. With Microbuilt, you can customize the products you need and how much you want to spend, and all their products are provided through a single, simple access portal. Whether you're working in originations or debt collection, screening a potential hire or tenant, planning for growth, or keeping up with regulatory requirements, Microbuilt can be your partner, providing the insight and information you need to protect your business, grow your bottom line, and keep your company running smoothly. For more information, please contact Microbuilt at 1-800-884-4747 or visit www.microbuilt.com. And just as an FYI, Microbuilt is spelled M-I-C-R-O-B-I-L-T, microbuilt.com. Thanks again to Microbuilt for sponsoring today's webinar. I want to jump in. We've got a bunch of questions that have come in so far. So maybe we'll tackle a couple of these before we move on. One question, I think we talked a little bit about this, but just want to make sure we address it. Is there any comment on the use of expedited delivery of collection letter, such as using UPS or FedEx, though without the urgent label on the envelope? Does anyone want to tackle that one?
Well, I think it fits in line with the DHL tactic we tried. It's hard. I don't want to act like we've sent thousands of those in a batch. I mean, it's usually a couple one-offs. We tried it with a specific type of debt to just try to see. I don't know if we ever really decided. We're still using them a little bit on how effective that is. I don't think certainly you can expedite a letter via USPS, via FedEx. Of course, it's a great point about urgency labels and other things, especially if you're sending it a G notice via that method or something within your 30 days. But I think that there's some room there for, you know, and I think Brent was saying there's not really much to do on the envelope side where we're so restricted. Using a delivery method and their corresponding packaging is a truthful way of sending something if that's the way in which it's being delivered. Saying something like express mail, it means that's the method it's going and it's 100% truthful. Now, if it says, and I know FedEx is, I think, says urgent or something on an overnight. Now that maybe implies that the message itself is urgent, and now we're getting into a little semantics difference. So I do think you have to be acknowledge, and again, what I'm saying is not, I am a lawyer, what I'm saying is not legal advice, it's got to be specifically tailored, it's got to be reviewed and researched properly, but my first inclination would be something that describes the mechanism of which it's sent, as long as it's truthful, is not inherently misleading. Something that applies to the message itself that's inside, that goes beyond something personal and saying personal and confidential may be skewing it if you're saying something's urgent, but we know that they have 30-day rights attached to it.
Right.
Okay, excellent. Another question. How about using a paper that mimics the old check paper showing through the window, giving the impression of a check?
I don't like that. I think that would be kind of, or very misleading.
Okay.
And when I see those, I know they're fake anyway. You know, like you get these notices from these lenders and you can tell that it's not even a handwritten check, but a check through there. And then when you open it and it says, you know, $40,000, call, you could be eligible. You know, they're all fake. I think they're just too gimmicky. If that makes any sense.
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. You know, obviously many parts of a collection letter have been litigated and the courts have determined what is allowed and what is not allowed. I wanted to ask and get some insights from the panel. What are some of the rulings that may be often overlooked by collection agencies that they should be paying more attention to? Anyone want to take that one first?
Sure, it's Ari here. I mean, you know, we've had a couple cases that haven't gone our way in recent years. We've had a couple that have. I think a big takeaway when Jeff is reviewing these letters, when I'm reviewing these letters is, you know, speaking in very uncertain terms to a consumer, using the words may, using the words might, they used to be very accepted languages of possibilities that could occur. So we used to have language on a letter. This is an old letter. It's not in use anymore. We were indeed sued upon it. We did indeed, you know, lose in an attempted MTD. And instead of fighting it through, we just changed the friggin' letter. It said, you know, if his debt's not paid, our client may exercise various options to enforce collections. And they said, well, you're threatening to sue us for that. We're like, no, we're not. We said they may exercise various options to enforce. And, you know, of course, this wasn't a decision on, you know, after full discovery or, you know, it wasn't, a summary judgment motion. The plaintiffs merely survived. But part of the court's reasoning was that regardless of if it's formally a threat or not, a statement that implies that you're going to take action you have no intention of taking, that has carefully crafted language chosen to obscure the rights of a debtor is just the sort of tactic that the FDCPA prohibits. And I'm talking about language from the Seventh Circuit's, I believe it's a Pantoja case came out a couple years ago, which was saying, we're not talking about threats or no threats. We're talking about, are you coming up with intentionally vague language to throw a debtor off their game? And, you know, for many years that was permissible. So now I think really monitoring what consequences you're listing and, you know, are maybe you don't take them 100% of the time. Nothing is 100%. A dispute could come in before someone credit reports. You know, something can happen to an account, but is this a realistic possibility of what's going to happen through the life cycle of, you know, of an account? Jeff, maybe you could just really briefly, as an example to that, talk about how we changed this, some of our credit reporting language with those accounts that weren't slated to report.
Yeah, so we had a few years ago, we had a credit reporting letter which essentially stated, you know, your accounts may be reported to the credit bureaus and then itemized a list of their accounts on the front of the letter. And what we realized was happening was that even though, you know, the creditor for those accounts was one that we would generally, you know, do credit reporting for, the specific accounts listed in the letter, some of them are sometimes all of them were not going to be reported based on a balance threshold or no social date of birth, some of the NCAP requirements that had come out that essentially changed the minimum requirements for credit reporting, made those accounts ineligible. So we had to basically redesign the entire letter to take into account these various requirements, whether they're client requirements like a balance threshold or bureau requirements like full social or date of birth on the account.
Yeah, we did the same thing. We had wording that said this account may be reported to the credit bureau, and you know, we took that off after we were wisely advised by an attorney when we had our letters reviewed. But that language was very confusing to the consumer.
Totally agree. We also, even like you said, that very language of may report to the bureaus. You know, now it says this contains important credit reporting information and only contains facts within it. Like, this account has not yet been reported but remains eligible for reporting. This account is not eligible for report. I mean, it's amazing how truthful this letter is, but it's also, look, we all can empathize. How did this all start? Someone got a letter saying you might be credit for a couple years ago, and they waited 7 months and said, well, you never did it now, meaning you never will. So we're saying, just to get this clear, your complaint is that you were told you might be reported and that you never were, and that is what your claim is. And sure enough, yes, that's true. And it's an amazing world in which we live, and we all know that. We could complain for hours about it. But sometimes plaintiff's lawyers are the best compliance lawyers, in the sense that they're causing us to shake and move and change things that will improve what we have to do in the long run.
Well, how do you feel about settlement language? You know, it's like we would send out a settlement, and we now add language to our letters that says, you know, we're not required to renew this offer, but send out settlement letters that actually have a deadline on them. I know that in a previous environment, we had a couple of lawsuits where, you know, we gave a definite end date for the settlement, and then lo and behold, the client approved the settlement after the expiration date, and we got sued. So how do you feel about letter language that talks about the settlement? Puts a deadline on them.
You know, settlements that have no deadline are open, you know, even at common law, they're open for a reasonable time, right? And that
right.
Anytime you have an open-ended date, you get into sort of some problems with that. But the deadlines, I'll say we don't do much on the deadline side. You know, usually we've got an offer that goes out. We do say we're not obligated to renew. And I think that if you have a deadline and you say you're not obligated to renew, you know, you've complied with the law. You know, the issue is, are you going to be accepting them in practice well after that date's passed? Are you going to send them a letter 2 weeks after that deadline with an offer again and again? And if it starts to be a practice where someone notices the deadlines are completely meaningless, I could see someone making an issue out of it. But I think you've got some leeway. I think you're fully within your rights to pull the offer after a deadline. But if you notice that you're always going to accept that from the moment the account, the deadline passes until the end of the life cycle of the account, you're probably better off not putting it on there and continuing to leverage that settlement on your second, third, fourth letters, because everybody would rather pay less. And if you haven't gotten traction on your full balance request, I don't personally love the deadlines that much, but sometimes clients are saying, hey, look, this is a tax season amnesty issue. This is, you know, and granted, government stuff is a little bit exempt from the FDCPA. We have that benefit. We're working those. But they often do amnesty periods where if you're a day late on the amnesty, they're not going to take it. So, you know, sometimes you don't have a choice. Your client's going to dictate that. But if you have it within your rights to take blanket authority, I'm someone who believes once you kind of get to the date, I'm not saying it's a one-size-fits-all, but I like to sort of honor it throughout.
Yeah. So why is that safe language? We are not required to renew this offer. You know, why does that save me? What's so safe about that?
Hey, this is Brandon. I got knocked off again. And I'm,
yeah, Brandon, take this.
Yeah, I really apologize. I don't know what's going on. I just, while I got knocked off the last time, I got someone to check in and see if we're having like service issues today or what's going on, but I never have this issue. But so the reason we are not obligated to renew this offer is safe harbor language that came from the Seventh Circuit. I can't remember the name of the case offhand, and other courts have adopted that. Now, personally, I don't think it's the most clear language, but courts have kind of established that that's if you have a deadline and you about to go out again. So I'm sorry, but that's where that comes from.
Okay. We got the end of that. We just lost a little bit near the end there, but we got most of that.
So as far
just to be clear on that, just to piggyback on Brandon, and because we're in the seventh and we know it, and I hope everyone, he said what he said was exactly right, and I know where he was going with it, is it creates a very cautious balance between saying, I mean, agencies of course want to be able to renew the offer again, just because you said it once and you had a deadline, you want to be able to renew it, yet you don't want to say it. So what ended up happening was people were saying one-time offer, pay within 2 months, it's a one-time offer, and then the offer had expired, and the agency is like, well, I told them one time, so I guess I got to charge them the full balance. The court said, well, it's in the interest of the debtor, if you want to renew the offer, that you have the right to, but you're not obligated to. So it creates this very fine line between, I might offer this to you again, so it's not a one-time offer necessarily, but I don't have to do it, so it might be. So they found a balance a little bit between a puffery and the truth, and how typical negotiations in any settlement outside of collections in the business world might work, is that the offer might be there. You know, Best Buy might offer you a deal today. I can't guarantee it's a once in a season sale. It might come up again, but it may not come up again for 6 months.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think there's plenty of case law that says that, you know, that settlement should be encouraged. The consumer should be given opportunities to resolve their debts at a discount. So courts are, you know, cognizant of that, and they don't want to do too much to discourage settlements. I think the key is to make sure you're not falsely conveying that there's an urgency that maybe doesn't exist. But I think there's certainly nothing wrong with a deadline. And in fact, we've seen lawsuits where there is no deadline, saying that you know, that creates a confusion for the consumer, and that one way to read the lack of a deadline is that payment is due immediately. So, you know, these consumer attorneys are sometimes clever enough that whatever you do is gonna open you up. But just, I think it's important to remember, courts recognize that settlements are to be encouraged, and they don't want to do too much to discourage it, but they sure have put in some rules that make it tough.
One of the areas that I have found to be risky for an agency is the one-off letters that are sent internally. You got that one consumer on the phone, supervisor after hours, wants to send a settlement letter, and the validation notice hadn't been sent, and so then they take our letters and they kind of change the words around. I found out that was going on at an agency, and we had to put some policies and procedures in place, and that's a very risky area when you have your client services staff under the direction of a frontline supervisor or a collector saying, hey, put this on a letter. Can you fax this letter to this consumer or email this letter to this consumer, and it's not been vetted by anyone? How do y'all control that?
You know, that's a great point, and we have to, this is probably 10 years ago now, a tactic was where, you know, our compliance team would never know about it. Somebody, right. a rep after hours would, you know, go fishing on an account by sending a payment plan confirmation, you know, from a letter vendor, you know, sending it to be automatically requested when that wasn't what happened in the conversation. They never reached a payment arrangement at all. There was never, and here they're sending, you know, someone might say, hey, I can't pay today. Call me back in a month. And then they get a letter saying, thanks for agreeing to your payment plan. Now, a clear cut violation. And that's, I think that's probably 2009 or 10 when we had a one-off situation like that happen. And that's what really led to us putting a lot of a stranglehold on who could request, you know, what letters. Now, we found a way in the last year to allow the reps, and we use Columbia Ultimate Business Systems, CUBS we call it, from Ontario. And we found a way to, you know, sort of the collection floor is like, you guys are taking a long time to review these one-off letters upstairs. How can we get some power back to the supervisors on the floor? Jeff, maybe, you know, the side action stuff that we've done?
Yeah, so what we ended up doing was, it, you know, our situation was kind of like what you were describing, where reps on the floor would, you know, send an email to someone in client services or wherever saying, hey, can you fax this or mail this to the debtor, and they would do it. And sometimes, you know, they would play with the language a little bit, and it was hard to keep things consistent. So what we ended up doing was programming these, I think they're called side action strategies in Cubs, where reps, and I think we may have actually limited it to supervisors, are able to request a letter through Cubs from a variety of different templates that we have. So one might be just a simple, what we would call balance letter, where someone says, hey, it's been a while since I received a letter from you guys. I just want something in writing showing me what I owe right now before I start on a payment plan. There's that. There were, paid in full letters where, someone just wants a confirmation of their payment over the phone, payment plan letters, things like that. So that kind of made it simpler and standardized the one-off letters that we were sending out.
Essentially, what it does, in part, Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, is it allows for the condition to be checked by the automation. So if you request a paid in full letter, it will block it if there's an $8 balance because the supervisor may just want to, they don't want to collect the $8 anymore. They're like, I don't care, but of course it's not paid in full. Our client's going to demand the $8 remaining. The IT system, the Cub system would block that because the side action strategy would say they're requesting a PIF letter. We're allowing them to request it, but the conditions are not met for that letter being sent. So there's essentially, they're only allowed to request these five types. But for those five types, there's conditions that you put into place where if those conditions are not met, we'll get a report of all the blocked letters and you'll be able to look at them as to why it was blocked.
Yes. And one of those to go to LaDonna's point was that all of the letters are blocked within the validation period. So if we had sent a G notice, less than 35 days ago, any of those one-off letters would be rejected.
Unless it was like a receipt for, unless they paid in
unless
full.
Unless they paid in full, yeah.
This is Brent. Just to jump in real quick on, first of all, when you're talking about one-off letters, that's music to my ears because that means that generally means no class action. So even if something is wrong, then it's always nice not to have to worry about a class. But I think that all these points.
Brent, I thought you were going to say you love one-off letters because that means someone's going to get sued because someone did something weird and you were going to get retained.
Right.
And then you said a very nice comment.
No class actions is a good thing. And I think everything that Ari, you were talking about there with all the safeguards and the guardrails and all that is great. I think you do it with the automation to the extent you can to control the letter. Templates are great, but make sure you get those templates reviewed when you get your other letters reviewed. And then also training. And I think the important thing with all those things is to document it, because if something does go wrong with one of these letters and you do get sued, hopefully you've got a bona fide error defense to fall back on. So I think all these things are great, but they're even better if they're well documented and we can use them to assert a bona fide error defense if it ever comes to that.
Switching gears, it's tax season. Y'all got any tips for me on how I can increase revenue? Or do your operational folks make your letter strategies for tax season? Do they run it through your compliance folks? Do they run it through legal? Or they just say, hey, we've scored these accounts and we want to send out 97,000 letters? How do y'all control that?
This is Mike LaDonna. I heard orange envelopes work really well.
No.
I thought this was crazy when we started out, but my ops have convinced me otherwise, that explaining to somebody that, they have a right to spend their money how they choose, it sounds really weird to me, but we've had some letters, certain letters for tax season that'll say, you may have received, and I know when I say may, we're back to our other conversation, but you say, you may have received a tax refund. If you did, you may want to elect to, pay your account with that refund. And I don't know, those letters have a decent rate of return on them. Like basically calling out to someone, if you're expecting a tax refund, that's how we said it, just to say not me. If you're expecting a tax refund, kindly consider paying this debt with it. And I'm like, really? But maybe it's just because in the season people have more money or collections are higher during these seasons, but the letters themselves, when just kind of pinging them saying, if you're expecting a refund, think about using it for this. And I don't know, the letter does pretty well. There's also some agencies that use banners or, you know, will circle it and say, you know, use any eligible tax refund today. You know, obviously not on a validation where you're saying today you're doing this, that, whatever. But, you know, you've got some stuff on there. Maybe it's a different color. You talk about different fonts. You've seen that with like a blue font and a circle. You know, use any eligible tax refund to pay this debt. And I think those do pretty well. They're not that creative, to be honest, but they do decently well, I think.
Do you score before you send them out?
Depends on the business line, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
It depends on the business line. You know, Jeff, why don't you talk a little bit about what we found when we put in tax time, and we know that, you know, there's reps on the phone all the time. You're dealing with inbounds, higher wait times that our clients hate. And you'd love to, you know, you talked about the portal last time and how you can direct people to paying and not even have to deal with a rep. But even you talk about maybe the idea of creating the payment plan, like on the letter. That was interesting. That has a good rate of return.
Yeah. So one of the letters we've started sending out in tax season is instead of offering them a payment plan or a settlement in the letter, we had some where we would essentially lay out the terms of a payment plan within the letter and allow them to check a box and start the payment plan with their first payment. So it makes it a lot easier than, you know, traditionally on some letters we would say pay in full or offer them a settlement and then say, if you can't afford this, call our office and enroll in a payment plan. And, you know, they would talk to representative, decide on a monthly amount and handle it that way. But with the letter option, it kind of gave them, you know, a low monthly payment. They could start it without having to talk to anyone and just send in their first check and begin it that way. And then
you lay it out, right? You say like the down payment of X with monthly payments of Y
and a final
starting on the date of X and on the first date of the month thereafter for X month. You basically like, it's a lot of language, but they check it and it's got a decent rate of them complying with the plan, I feel.
Yeah, it does.
Do y'all use IMB codes or anything to track delivery of your letters and then maybe build dialing campaigns based on that? I tried that and it worked.
We track mail returns. We're tracking that and doing that in, you know, in batch from vendors helping with that. But, I don't know how they if they coordinate off of that.
You can do that, and I've had much success with that, and it kind of also legitimizes the debt collector when they call the consumer, and the consumer's like, well, and go, well, we just mailed you a letter, and you received it, you know, on the 5th, and maybe it's in your junk pile, but then they start talking about the debt, and that kind of
gives you an idea. Well, you're saying actually tracking delivery. You're saying tracking delivery, not just tracking mail return, but tracking delivery. Is that cost effective?
Yeah, and it's less than a penny. I mean, it's very cheap. Most of your letter vendors do it.
That's really interesting. I don't know how much I've actually talked with our ops about, you know, we see when it's sent and you can, you know, think they're going to get it 2, 3, 4 days from that point. Right. I don't know if we're, you know, it probably does give a lot of credibility in this world of scams when you're like, look, we know you got this letter on the 5th and that's, I'm writing that down.
Yes. It's very helpful, even outside of tax season.
We've got another couple of questions that I want to throw out there and see what everybody thinks. A question, any insight on the CFPB B3 letter going to a legal 14-inch paper versus 11-inch, similar to the New York ruling in 2015.
Jeff?
Jeff's laughing.
I hear
you. You know, we switched to a bigger letter, and it hasn't been hard for the vendor to figure that out. We switched to it more for how it's folded and how, you know, you can get a little more info on it, the tear off. I don't know, you know, Jeff and I were talking about the CFPB model notice the other day, and I think Jeff and I feel the same way about validations, and it's sort of like, I don't know. It's probably not the area to get that creative anyways. So would you trade the sort of liability decrease with a safe harbor letter for removing a lot of creativity, even as it applies to the size of the letter? What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we all know a validation notice is probably the most heavily litigated letter for, you know, that a collection agency is going to send. So having that safe harbor would be, you know, really helpful in reducing our defense costs. But also, I think, you know, we really can't get that creative with the validation notice in the first place. And, you know, I know our operations folks have said that, you know, we get a lot of payments off of validation letters. But I think part of that is that some people, when they get a letter saying they owe a debt, they just pay it.
You know, so like 5 years ago, I'm thinking, remember we did this, we don't use this anymore. Ops said, we really want a settlement offer in a validation. It's sort of like Inception or whatever. Like, can you do the craziest? Can you go into another world and do the craziest thing here? You got to be very careful how you craft something like that. I hate doing that. I think settlements are something you should reserve for after you try to get the full balance. That's the whole idea. But sometimes you're working secondary placements. You're trying to, you know, how do you come out? And that's the beauty of the government stuff, by the way. Is, you know, you're FDCPA exempt on it. You can throw exclamation marks in there, pay this now. When you're not in the FDCPA world, of course you can apply with the spirit of it, but you don't have to apply with the technicalities of it. And so that's beautiful. But when you're really in that FDCPA world, trying to get someone a settlement offer, but making it clear that it doesn't impact their 30-day rights and that payment's not due for X period of time afterwards, they begged me in ops to get this letter. This is probably 5 years ago. And we did it. Didn't get hit on anything because we did it really well. Went through it with outside count. I mean, how many lawyers can you have looking at a letter? We probably paid thousands of dollars in not only internal resources, but external to do it right. And guess, we are so weird. It didn't have any difference. Like, it was not a very successful letter for whatever reason. And it sort of hit me that, you know, your validation, your G notice, it's there's such a, you know, recitation of their rights. It's taken on such a point, like, I don't know. I don't know if there's ever any magic bullet to making something incredibly collectible, but also complying with A, B, C, D, and, you know, Z on this stuff.
This is Brent. I agree with that. We see a lot of overshadowing claims, even on letters where I think it's been studied and done right. You know, I think you're still going to probably see some consumer lawyers take some cracks at you because, you know, it's easy to allege that something is overshadowing. But the FDCPA specifically says that you can undertake collection activity during the 30-day period as long as it doesn't overshadow. The question is whether it does. And I think you really do have to do your due diligence on that issue and make sure and read it a number of times and get, you know, I would get an outside opinion on whether the letter can be read to overshadow. But legally, there's nothing wrong with it as long as you do it right.
So how often do y'all get your letters reviewed? You know, some states have specific requirements, but, you know, being attorneys, most of y'all, and, you know, I'm just happy to be hanging out with you smart guys. How often would you recommend that, you know, shops get their letters reviewed?
No more than hourly.
Well, look, we have the benefit of having in-house lawyers here. That, I understand, is a benefit. So, you know, when a letter goes out, and that's why I dragged Jeff into this webinar, because he's reviewing everything before it goes to our vendors. And we have a letter team that's crafting and making these letters, and, you know, ops is putting in their insight, and we're redlining it and making sure. Now, that's probably not something every agency has to do. I'd also say, I'm embarrassed to say how many letters we have. And what I mean is, it's two letters when there's one word difference between the two. But, you know, we've got healthcare clients that demand we put certain charity language on it. Well, now I've got the same letter, but it's done twice because they're two different clients and there's two different charity, you know, language on those two letters. So, you know, because we have so many clients like that, I don't know if that's unique to us or not. There's just so many letters to review. I would hope and I would pray that, You know, some agencies are better able to standardize that, which creates less pressure on the review process. And if you're doing that and you're reviewing them, you know, every year with the understanding that there's someone either in your office or outside of your office paying very close to case law that is really key, you know, that's probably sufficient. But as we know, a case could come along in every jurisdiction where you heavily operate that really might require you to change something in a day's notice or in 2 days' notice. And so having someone monitoring that in the background, in addition to probably looking at the overall climate of litigation, you know, half yearly or yearly, you're probably in a good spot.
Yeah, this, you know, one of the things I want to say about letter review is a lot of times we're thinking about letter review, we're talking about the templates, the structure of the language, the actual words that are in there, and it's important to get that reviewed. But you know, one of the things we see sometimes is they always come with the blanks, so the fields, you know, indicating there's a field here, and there's nothing there. And I think it's important whether you're doing it internally, and I would do it as part of your external review, have some of them populate because, and do that from time to time to make sure your numbers or your data, whether it's the name of the creditor or original creditor, if you're doing that, make sure it's populating correctly, because you can have a perfect letter and then all of a sudden something goes wrong with the software and that letter becomes problematic because of what's going into the fields.
That's, I mean this seriously, that may have been the most important thing anyone's mentioned in the whole webinar. Jeff and I are looking at each other, we're like, we should have said that because we're dealing with it all the time. I mean, you look at a letter and it looks awfully different when a creditor name is populated than when it says X46 at sign. Mm-hmm. And when a detail box says, you know, violation listed here or patient date here, like actually seeing something populate. Because, you know, sure, I mean, if something doesn't go right, you can try bona fide error. But anybody who is litigating these and who's going through it and is dealing, you know, in the plaintiff space quite a bit, knows that they know very well that a BFE defense is often a win for them if it's in a single action case, because you've got to get, you know, to summary judgment to get anything done there. You're not going to get an MTD on a BFE. It's impossible to do. So, you know, their claim of 1,000 plus fees, they're sitting pretty at a BFE. You can protect yourself from catastrophic loss on something like that, but your single action cases, you know, them, they'll tell me, well, you're stuck proving BFE. Good luck. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, that's not BFE a win for
like,
us.
BFE, the bona fide error defense, is like an insurance policy with a high deductible.
Exactly.
Is kind of how that
it
works.
Prevents it against good faith errors.
Yeah.
And it's a nice throw-in on defense, but you know that's going to cost you. No, it's not going to cost you $1 billion, but you know that a plaintiff's attorney is more than happy to resolve a case right there. So you're right. Looking at the fields and how they populate, and if there's a mistake there, you know someone's going to pop you for a few grand.
Well, the reason
that's why.
The reason I say that is because we're actually seeing a lot of the lawsuits there where that's the case. And I think it's because people have gotten better about getting their letters reviewed and making sure their letters are correct. So, you know, those easy lawsuits are going away. And now, you know, I've seen a lot of lawsuits recently where there's really nothing wrong with the letter except for the information. There's something that goes wrong with the information, whether it be the, you know, the fields for the various cost and fee amounts, if that's a requirement, or particularly in states where that's a requirement to give the breakdown. And also we're seeing a lot of lawsuits over the identity of the creditor, which is part of what's required in a validation notice. You got to get the name of the creditor. And it's amazing how many ways consumer lawyers can sue over the way you disclose the name of the creditor.
And an internal audit can be your BFF. And you can discover a lot of things through internal auditing.
Yeah, and I know on, you know, a lot of the, when we create a letter here, what we, you know, we'll often look at like a draft mock-up that they've prepared before they even set it up at the letter vendor. We've gotten to the point where we, you know, have them send back samples from the letter vendor along with some test accounts so we can actually look at how the data is filling in those fields. But some of it is also asking questions like, what clients are you going to be using this letter for? Because, you know, we might create a letter for, you know, this specific healthcare client, and then, you know, two months, a year down the line, we're using it for a utility client, and you have a field that says patient name with the consumer's name in there.
I think it's, and don't take the word of your IT person or your ops, whoever's crafting the letter, to say, yeah, of course it's going to populate the business rule for California and the Rosenthal Act. State disclaimer, we're not sending it to you on this version because we haven't set it up at the vendor yet, but yeah, it's going to be on there. And then you go and look at the actual ones in production, like Jeff said, where is this is going to a Los Angeles address? Why is there not on there? Oh, we forgot. The vendor forgot to put the programming. Yeah, unless you're actually looking, like Brent said, at a real live breathing letter with all the fields and all the disclaimers, you really can't attest to the compliance and to the actual review of what it says.
Well, on that note, I have to jump in here because unfortunately we've run out of time, although I do think that you guys could keep going for a long time talking about this topic, which is great because you've done an awesome job and there's still a lot to cover. So I'm sure we'll be doing more of these in the future. But I want to thank LaDonna, Ari, Jeff, and Brent again for their time and their insights today. This was a great conversation, a great discussion. I know I learned a lot. I got a bunch of ideas for things in the future. So thank you so much, panel. This was great. I also want to thank Microbuilt one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.microbuilt.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. We tried to get to as many of them as we could. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar to help identify topics and speakers that will be of the best use to you going forward. What do you want to learn more about? What issues are causing you problems? Those are, you know, how these webinars get started. So feel free to share, and I'll do my best to get it up for a webinar in the future. I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Something I've been doing for some webinars in the past and been telling the panelists, but never really told anybody else, to thank the panelists for their participation today. I'll be making a donation in their name to the American Red Cross. So as they helped the industry today with their perspective and their insights, I hope that the donation can help others in need. So thanks a lot, panelists. Really appreciate it. Great job.
Thanks, everyone. This was fun.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Great weekend.
All right, everybody. Take care. Bye.